Welcome to this episode of the Insights Podcast on the Acadia Broadcasting Network. I'm Don Mills.
And I'm David Campbell.
David, we had such an interesting conversation with David Hawkins and such a wide-ranging conversation that we decided that it is worth having a two-part series.
Yeah, so David is a legend in our region in the marketing and communications business, and he's had a wide-ranging career over 50 years, including a lot of volunteer work, so we just couldn't squeeze it into 1 hour.
No, and just to remind people who may not be familiar with his name, he was the founder of Hawk Communications, which was one of the really early success marketing advertising agencies in the region. Actually started, of all places, in Sackville, New Brunswick. And he evolved it to a place where he had 70 employees, which in that business in this region was a big business, and I believe 5 different locations. So he was, I would not only describe him as a legend, but a bit of a pioneer in terms of building the marketing and advertising industry sector in our region.
I think that's right. I mean, he ended up working with many, if not most, of the largest corporations in our region, including McCain's and Irving's and the tourism account for the government of New Brunswick. So all of the big files, he built enough capacity here to be able to work with those very large firms.
He was also one of those people who, you know, he has a big right brain, and you know, he was creative in terms of building the business. He built a bit of an integrated model for the advertising sector. He talks about that in our first part of our conversation and how that gave him an advantage over other agencies. So, you know, very innovative in that space early on. And it's worth, you know, worth listening to for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the other thing I just want to mention is that, you know, I've known David Hawkins for a really long time. I knew of him, obviously, because and you know, I was part of the CCL group of companies where, you know, we were direct competitors in that group. Always respected them. It's interesting. Like, you know, when you compete with somebody, sometimes you respect the competitors, sometimes you don't. And in this case, I had big respect for David. And then later on, after he sold his business and he had to sit out a non-compete, he ended up working with the CCL group and playing a senior role with the group in New Brunswick. And that's where I really got to know him and like him as a person. And the other thing that I really wanted to highlight in the introduction is that David has done an enormous amount of community work. He not only is he a business builder, but he's a community builder. And you know, he's been in so many different causes. He's just been really disproportionately important to his home province of New Brunswick. And I just wanted to point that out because it's been, it's probably one of the things that helped lead him to the New Brunswick Hall of Fame. It's not just his business acumen, but it's also the work that he did to make New Brunswick a better place.
That's right. It was baked right into his business philosophy, this idea of giving back. And of course, I met David in a similar activity way back in the early 1990s. So Don, you and I have known him a long time, and I think the listeners will appreciate his story, but also his comments on the state of the industry today, the marketing communications industry, politics. We cover a wide variety of issues in this two-part interview.
Yeah, so with that introduction, here's the first part of our two-part conversation with David Hawkins. We call him a marketing and advertising legend. Even though he does not, he's not fond of that description, I think we can say it. So here's that conversation. Our guest on this episode is David Hawkins, a marketing and advertising legend in Atlantic Canada. David, welcome to the Insights Podcast.
Well, thanks so much, John and David. I think you two are the legends. And, I'm the tag along, but appreciate the opportunity to chat with you and share some thoughts and experiences with whoever chooses to watch. Yeah.
So, David, you've had a remarkable career in the field of marketing and advertising over the past advertising over the past 50 years. I was just thinking about it. You're probably the most well-known person in the marketing space in our region. I don't know if Don would agree with that, but I think that's probably where you've been positioned over the past three or four decades. So that's quite an achievement. I think you recently decided to retire. I don't buy it. Then unretired. You're originally from Montreal. You became a Maritimer by choice. Can you give our listeners just a little history of our of your career, where you started, the businesses that you founded, and the journey to where we are today?
Well, you know, I actually started school in the United States, and I often look back and feel that just having that cultural hit at a young age conditioned me to, you know, a bit of an entrepreneurial life. And it's true that for the most part, I grew up in Montreal. My father was an entrepreneur and small business. And so we were surrounded by that as children. And I worked with my dad as a teenager. And then he passed when I was quite young. And I went to work with a very entrepreneurial company in the, you know, the, I guess you would know them as Nikon and Minolta as a consumer. We had a lot of other brands in the photo optical business. And I got immersed in business at a very, you know, when I was 20 years old, full time on that basis. And so I was really fortunate to get thrown in the deep end of the pool at a young age and get a lot of experience quickly with a company that was doing business right across Canada with international brands. And so, you know, I remember the day I started with Nikon Minolta, we were in touch with the Japanese, right, who were coming over here for a visit for Expo 67. And so we had a setup to host them here in Canada. So immediately you're into, you know, a range of activities that not too many 20-year-olds would get exposure to. So I was, you know, it was a great start to my modest career. anyway, so you know, Nikon Minolta, we were the largest photo optical distributor in Canada, which on one hand doesn't sound like that much. On the other hand, in that business, it was quite a bit because we had retailers right across the country in pretty much every community. And I would be in touch with them daily. So it was a lot of experience, you know, in a short period of time. And as luck would have it, it was very circumstantial. I became the, it's not because I was so smart or whatever, I wasn't, but it's just really as luck would have it, I became the national advertising manager of that company when I was 22 years old. And then all, you know, then I was really thrust into it, and we were working with, you know, I had ad agencies that reported to me in Montreal, Toronto, and New York City. And I was dealing with them every day. So again, it was just circumstantially, as luck would have it, it was a huge amount of exposure at a very young age to the whole marketing and communications world, such as it was at the time. And I don't mind saying that such as it was at the time was very, very close to the TV series Mad Men. So, and I'm not exaggerating, but it was, if you watch Mad Men, all I can tell you is I lived in that world. It was a huge amount of drinking, smoking, a whole bunch of other activities that, you know, where I suppose some people saw as fun and other people saw as kind of dysfunctional, but that was the industry. And, you know, in the advertising business, and this was in Montreal, really, first of all, you're in Quebec. And, you know, in Quebec, in the advertising business, it's kind of like anything goes, right? It was just the culture in Montreal at the time. You know, you could smoke anything you wanted to, drink anything you wanted to, go out with whoever you wanted to, say anything you wanted to, do anything you wanted to. It was just you know, it was part of the entertainment business. The ad agency business was part of the, so I met some very colorful people. And then even more so working with our agency in New York City. So, but I got burnt out at a young age, you know, by the age of 27, I got to tell you, I was, I was just plain burnt out. There's no other way to put it. I had been a lot of places, done a lot of things, worked a staggering amount of time, and needed a break, which is how I got to the Maritimes. Yeah.
Right. So you moved in 1978. You started your advertising and public relations firm in the metropolis of Sackville, New Brunswick, called Hawk Communications, with your late wife, Lori Bell Hawkins.
That's right. Well, what happened is I moved to New Brunswick, and I decided during that kind of burnout period that I mentioned that I would kind of go back to school. I was undereducated, and I thought I would go to Mount Allison. So I went to Mount A, which is how I got to Sackville, and I met Lori there, and we got together 2 years later, and then we started Hawk Communications in 78, as you mentioned. It was just the two of us. We had no money at all. We lived in a little farmhouse out on the Tantramar Marsh that we had built ourselves with her help of her father, and we just wanted to live in the country. We wanted to live in Sackville. We both grew up in Montreal. In fact, we went to the same high school, so we had a very common background. Dawn, I think we went to the same high school as your wife.
That's right. Exactly. Beacon Hill High. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, so there we were, and you know, we had a very common value system, and we wanted to stay in the Maritimes. We wanted to stay in Sackville. So we started Hawk. It was really more of a graphic design studio at the time, and then it didn't take more than a couple of days, frankly, before people were asking us to, you know, did we do advertising type work as opposed to, say, pure design work? And I had had this background with Nikon Minolta in advertising, so sure, we would take on small assignments, and it just grew from there, you know. Yeah. And you know, so again, I'll just finish off by saying, yep, it's funny how I used the word circumstantial before. Well, you know, we hadn't thought about it, but it just turned out that circumstantially, obviously Sackville was where Mount Allison was located, and it didn't take long before they needed to do some recruitment advertising. And we had no idea about this at the time, but it was also the Eastern headquarters for what we think of today as Loblaws. And so they had all kinds of communications needs. And between Mount A and was called Atlantic Wholesalers, Loblaws was called Atlantic Wholesalers. So they ran Save Easy stores at the time. For those who have been around for a while, there was 72 of those all over the Maritimes. So they became our two of our largest clients, and we, you know, there they were right in our backyard. We never thought about it when we started, but it didn't take long before, you know, we had the opportunity to work with them. And then there were some really good clients over in Amherst, just across the border. There was an arm of the provincial government over there, and we started doing all kinds of graphic work for them. And they had a little link to the tourism world, which became a big category for us. So again, we didn't have this master plan. I didn't have a master strategy. We just kind of, you know, we were available to be of service to whoever had a need for the kinds of things we could do. And it just grew, you know, one baby step at a time. Yeah.
So, David, over the years, Hawk Communications grew from a two-person operation to have around 70 employees and 5 offices, and to become one of the largest agencies in the region.
Yeah.
Thinking back, what were the key strategies that you used to grow your company?
Well, Don, that's a great question. And, you know, I never thought of it as a strategy. This is kind of an emotional topic for me, and hard for me to express why that is the case. But my mother and father were very, very strong believers in when it came to business and life, just being of service, right? They had met in the Army. When you're in the Army, you're in the service, right? And this was, you know, at a time when they grew up and the Second World War had started, and this was a strong focus, I say, for their generation and their culture. And so I kind of grew up with this, and so did my sister, with this, focus around a work ethic that was to be of service to others. And so in business, I remember my father teaching me a lesson at a very young age. I was about 12, actually. And he asked me to go call on a client. And he said, if you get there and the potential client asks you what you're doing and like why you're there and what your purpose is, just say to him, it was a Mr. Dao in St. Anne de Bellevue. And he said, all you need to say to him, well, Mr. Dao, I'm just here to be of service. How can I help you? Mm-hmm. And that was our number one strategy, was just to be of service. So whether it was Mount Allison University calling or Loblaws calling or McCain Foods, we just wanted to be of service, whatever it was. And, you know, everybody responded well to that. They liked the sentiment of that. They liked the idea of that. And everybody has needs, right? Everybody has, and they may just want to talk to you about their needs, even though they think you may not be able to fulfill them. But as they talk to you about them, you see an opportunity in the middle of them. So that was a key strategy. It was just being of service. It wasn't about us. It was always about the client. It was never about us, ever. And if there's one thing I really, really resist in business is whoever I'm working with, whether it's a colleague or freelancer, supplier, is this notion that some people have that it's all about them and their superior intelligence or creativity or experience. That's a lot of hooey, if you ask me. It's about putting the client first and being of service in whatever way you possibly can. And, you know, frankly, humbling yourself to that role. And I don't mean humble in an awkward way. I mean humbling in a way that you're prepared to do whatever is necessary to move them forward. 100% of the money comes from the client. You never forget that. It's not 99%, it's 100%. And so you stand in service to the client, and that's all there is to it. And they need to know that. And you need to know that, and everybody working with you needs to know that. So I don't know if that's a strategy, but it's a attitude, it's a point of view, and I started with that point of view, and I will probably end with that point of view. And if anybody wants to challenge me on that, they're going to lose.
To talk a little bit about some of the advertising campaigns, David. You've had been through the wars, as they say. Well, can you mention one or two that stand out for you in looking back?
Yeah, let's do that. Now, I'd like to come back to the strategy because there's one other thing I want to be sure.
Okay, sure. You bet.
Let's go to the ad campaigns. So I thought about this quite a lot, Don, and you know, we were involved in hundreds of campaigns, right? But I could rhyme off 20 of them here right now, but here's two or three that really stand out for me. One was when we started working with Sabian Symbols. It was December of 1978. Frank McKenna had just been elected, and that's how I know that that date. And Sabian had about an 8% market share, and they were up against a competitor, Zildjian, who would have had over 70% market share, and in a global market, right? And the long and short of it is, just to accelerate the story, is against all odds, there's a bit of a pun in there, we did some things and were able to sign Phil Collins, who at the time was a global superstar, and a Zildjian endorser. We were able to switch him over to being a Sabian endorser. So here's little Sabian in Maductic, New Brunswick, in a town of 78 people. and we had just signed Phil Collins, and Laurie and myself and the client, we went over to England and we photographed Phil in his studio south of London. So just imagine, we're going from tiny little Sackville, New Brunswick, to the personal at-home studio of Phil Collins a few months later. And then we featured Phil and his drummer, as Phil did double drumming. So he was a drummer himself, and he had somebody who drummed with him, Chester Thompson. And we were running this international, really global campaign featuring Phil and Chester Thompson. And everybody would have said, understandably, that's impossible. They would have said, that's ridiculous. Get the notion of signing Phil Collins out of your head. What I learned is Phil is just another human being like the people on this call and the people listening. And he's not going to agree to work with us if we don't ask him. So the first thing we need to do is step forward and ask, right? And as it turned out, we had something to offer Phil that he was very, very interested in. And the other part of that story is, I remember Bob Zildjian saying to us, listen, we don't have $250,000 to pay Phil Collins, and he's probably going to want $1 million. And so you might as well get rid of that idea. Like, you guys are smoking something, and like, he's just not going to agree to do this. And Phil did agree to do it, and he did it for nothing. We didn't have to pay him 5 cents. So that's what's possible. That's what's possible in the world. So that was a magnificent achievement in I think all of our experiences. Anybody who touched that, and that campaign went on for some time. It was a brilliant campaign. We had some wonderful creative people working on it, and we had a beautiful client. And Sabian, in about 5 to 6 years, I think it was about 5 years, went from 8% market share to 32% globally. So that's a profound achievement, again, coming from a little company in Maductic, New Brunswick. So another campaign much more recently that I'm really, really proud of, totally different sector. It was in the not-for-profit sector. We had, I guess, what many people would think of as a woman's shelter. Much more than that, but the woman's shelter was at the center of it. It's called the Beauséjour Family Crisis Resource Center in Shediac. They approached us about 6 years ago, and they wanted to run a capital campaign to raise, at the time, I think it was $3.2 million. And all I can tell you is I don't think up until that time anybody had ever raised, and they were in Shediac, just outside of Moncton. And I don't think anybody had ever raised $100,000 for anything in Shediac. So here we have a $3.2 million campaign for an organization that at the time was virtually unknown. And in fairness, the people who ran the Beauséjour Center, they had done a lot of homework on this campaign and kind of set the stage very nicely, but they had no communications and they really didn't know where to go. And they had 5 months to raise the first $2.5 million, or the federal contribution would go away. So we put that campaign together. And there's one piece of that I'd like to share with you. And by the way, the campaign went on to raise $5 million, and we used every cent of it. And the shelter got built, and it's a complete resource center. It's a beautiful, beautiful facility that serves a lot of people in southeastern New Brunswick who are having challenges. But in any case, at the front end of that, we were looking for a name for the campaign. And I had a very strong feeling, because we're in a bilingual community here, that the name should be the same name for the campaign in English and French, if we could find a way to get there. And we worked on that for a week or two, and we weren't getting anywhere. And our two creative directors at the time really kind of gave up on the challenge. And I remember them saying to me, listen, we need to go with an English name and a French name. We're just not going to get there. It's not possible. And I didn't believe that. I just didn't believe that. And I remember holding a meeting at which we invited a number of people into our boardroom who worked in the agency. And this was at BrainWorks, by the way, including some very junior people to contribute to the brainstorming to come up with a name. And we had a strong belief at Hawk and at BrainWorks that anybody could be creative. It, you know, the creative solution could come from anyone at any time. Could come from the client, could come from a supplier, could come from the people who do the cleaning, could come from the coffee maker, whatever. Could come from anybody. We just didn't think that the so-called creative people had all the creative ideas. So anyway, I remember sitting in this meeting and the creative directors had kind of given up on it. And there was a young woman, Chanel, who had joined. It was her first week with the agency. And she was sitting two seats over from me. And she had a pad of paper and a pencil. And I said, listen, here's what we're doing. We're looking for words that mean exactly the same thing in French and English. And so anybody who's working on this, just start writing down some words, see what we come up with. And remember, this is something the creative people had given up on, right? They just couldn't get there. And I glanced over at her after about 3 minutes, and I noticed that the third word down, she had the word, well, I pronounced it in French at the time. I remember courage, sort of courage, right? And I remember thinking, bingo, she's got it. Because it took a huge amount of courage for these women to come forward and present themselves to this center. And I thought, wow, that is such a great, great word. And, you know, Chanel, there she was. She was like 22. She had been with the company 2 days, maybe. But she was just so full of energy and creativity and, you know, just positivity. She had come up with a solution. And we used that title for the campaign for 4 years until we reached the $5 million. And to me, the reason I'd like to tell that story was a spectacular campaign, hugely successful. And I love to tell that story again to emphasize that everyone is creative, everyone. Yeah. And the resources all around you all of the time. Yeah. So those are two.
Sure. Those are great examples. And we're going to come back to your role, volunteer roles, which have been many over the years. But I did want to ask you a little bit about who you think, or tell us about your most important clients. I know you've worked with McCain's, Irving's, Bell, or excuse me, MBTEL, and so on. Give us a few examples of the important clients you've worked with.
Well, the big ones, really, McCain Foods was a game changer for us, you know. And I kind of knew a couple of the McCain family members because they had close roots to Mount Allison, but that actually was not what got us through the door there. What got us through the door where was being of service. And that's another story, and it'll take me 5 minutes to tell that. So I won't tell that right now, but McCain Foods became by far our largest, most active client, over the years. They were a tremendous client in every way imaginable. They took us places that you're only as good as your clients, right? It's just as simple as that. You know, people like to think, oh, no, you know, they beat their chest and they think all kinds of crazy things. But the bottom line is you're only as good as your clients. And you know, if you look at McCain Foods, who are their clients? I could pretty well tell you that if you wanted to track the growth of McCain Foods, I'll bet you that the line of its growth is a direct overlap with the line of McDonald's. Okay. McDonald's would be, if not their largest clients in the food service sector, then one of their largest clients. And so this is who you're known by. You're known by your clients. And so when we started working with McCain Foods, we became known for that. And I think people would say, well, if they're good enough for McCain Foods, they must be good enough for us, right? And I know that was a big influence with Sabian Symbols. I think if we hadn't worked for McCain Foods, I don't think Sabian, I'm not even sure they would have noticed us, right? So McCain were very, very important to us, but they weren't the only organization. We did a massive amount of work, and I believe that Hawk Communications still does work. I mean, for this organization, for Tourism New Brunswick. I don't know that they do or don't, but so Tourism New Brunswick would have been another very, very important client. And we initiated programs with tourism that they could not have initiated on their own, but we did it in partnership with them. And as things turn out, we both parties got very fortunate, and we succeeded, extremely well. And those programs went on for 25, 30 years. So so those were two big ones. Now, you mentioned the Irvings. The Irvings are a very different, well, there's not one Irving company. There are many Irving companies. We probably worked for five or six over the years. A very different commercial and enterprise culture than McCain Foods. Some people talk about them in the same breath, but we're really talking about two different types of organizations with two different structures, two different cultures, two different value systems in some respects, not every respect, and two major contributors to the Canadian and New Brunswick economies. So, you know, when you work with the Irvings, you do it in a much, much more structured, delineated, I would say disciplined way. My observation, and this isn't to be critical of anybody, is that in no way guarantees you a better result. We had dramatically more freedom in the McCain environment than we ever had in an Irving environment, but we had good outcomes in both. So so those are three big ones. And the work we did with Loblaws was sort of groundbreaking. I've got a wonderful story, probably the most successful ad campaign I've ever run. It goes back to the 80s, so it's a long time ago. And actually, it was for Save Easy Stores at the time. So this is pre the superstores. We launched the superstores in Atlantic Canada, but prior to the superstores was those Save Easy stores, 72 of them, which dotted so many communities in the Maritimes. And I remember one day I was sitting down in my office, and I put a pin on a maritime map where every Save Easy store was. And I noticed that most of them were in small town rural markets, not all of them, but probably 90% of them. And then I overlaid that with the radio stations that were available in those markets. And I noticed that most of them were country music stations. So I went to the advertising manager at, I'll call it Loblaws, and said, "Bob, have you ever noticed that there's a country music station where there's a Save Easy store for the most part?" And he said, "I never really noticed it in that way." And I said, "Well, there is." And I said, "You know, we should get an endorser for Save Easy who's a country music star, right?" And I said, "It's just going to connect with the audience. It just will." And so we did that. We signed Carol Baker, who was a kind of a significant Canadian country music singer at the time. And she became the voice and personality for Save Easy. And the outcome of that campaign was, if I were to tell you, you'd think I was exaggerating. But the bottom line is, we went in 2 years from, I think it was 12.6% market share to 19.7. That's like unheard of you're talking like $100 million shift here, hundreds of millions of dollars. It was just so popular. It also demonstrates the power of promotion and advertising. You know, people can say, "Oh, advertising doesn't make a difference," or promotion, like heck, it doesn't make a difference. so, you know, we would have personal, what would you call it? Personal appearances by Carol. I remember one we had in Lunenburg or wherever it was, and she was going to make a personal appearance, and she drives in her tour bus. And there's hundreds of people there, like hundreds of people waiting to greet and meet Carol, shake hands with her, whatever it happened to be, get her autograph. It was a wonderful promotional experience. It's a few years ago, but it was a really fun campaign. Yeah.
So let's fast forward to 2001. Yeah. It seems like that seems like an awful long time ago, but that's when you actually sold Hawk.
Yeah. It's
23 Can you tell years. Us about the decision to sell the company, why you made that decision, and who bought it?
Sure. Well, you know, Lori and I had been doing it at that time for 23 years. And to be candid about it, we were very tired. We were, you know, we'd started from nothing. We had no money when we started, like just plain zero. And we built it up to whatever it was. And you know, we had roughly 70 employees and various offices in different provinces. And we were very, very tired. And we had a buyer. We had someone who was interested in buying. And I guess, you know, I was just experienced enough to know that there's not going to be many buyers for this company. And we were ready to exit. So we took that opportunity. And one of the Irving family members was interested in being in the business, and that's who we sold to. And so it worked out well for us. They were, you know, one thing you can be sure of with the Irvings is that when you do business with them, they are people of their word. And so everything they said they were going to do, they did. I had a close personal, frankly, friendship relationship with Casey Irving in his last 3 or 4 years. And he was a gentleman through and through in terms of my relationship with him and Lori's. And it had nothing to do with this deal, which was many years later. But I found that that Casey had a lot of integrity, and that carried over to his children and grandchildren. And so I had a very good experience there, all things considered. Yeah.
Yeah. Company's still in business 45 years after you started it. What do you think is the secret to the longevity of a company like Hawk?
It could only be two or three things. One is a focus on customers. I mean, it just has to be a, you know, I don't know them well, but I know them a little bit, the people who run Hawk now. And I think they're down to earth people whose feet are on the ground, and they have a very strong focus on customers. And they must focus on one other thing that a lot of younger entrepreneurs either don't know or forget. And that is, you've got to take in more money than you spend. It's just that simple. It's no more complex. It sounds like the silliest, smallest, insignificant thing in the world, but I just can't tell you how many young entrepreneurs I meet who either don't know that or refuse to know it. They're just not willing to know it. They think there's some other secret. Well, there is no other secret. You can't go out of business making money. It's not going to happen. And you can do all kinds of other things, but you're not going to go out of business if you're making money. So not spending more money than you make is a fundamental element of running a successful business, as simple as it sounds, right? So, and I'll tell you, if the Irvings and the McCains, they know that exceedingly well. And I was going to take you back to the strategy thing. I wanted to share something about that. I remember riding on a train from Montreal to Sackville in our very early days. And I barely knew who the Irvings were at this time, being from Montreal, but I'd heard a lot about their vertical integration and knew a little bit about it. And I thought, in terms of Hawk Communications, I thought, you know, there's, to the extent that we can reasonably integrate vertically in a small market like Sackville or New Brunswick, this is probably going to be helpful to us. And so we decided that we would take our graphic studio and we would add on to it, say, a photographic studio. And then we added on digital typesetting. And in a, it may sound like nothing today, except this was 1980. Digital typesetting was a big investment. And most agencies wouldn't do this, and they wouldn't set up their own photographic studio. But if we didn't do it internally, it was very hard for us to buy. And I thought, well, you know, rather than jobbing this out to people in Halifax or wherever else they may be that have these facilities or capabilities, if we can find a way of doing that internally and taking in more money than we spend, then we're going to just do better as a business. So we did other things to vertically integrate. And in fairness, so did CCL, Don, right? CCL had a lot of vertical integration. May not have seen it that way, but doing the research as well as the public relations, doing public relations as well as advertising. You know, not all ad agencies did public relations or government relations. Those were distinctly different disciplines. So to say, okay, we're going to do all three because there's an overlap here and there's a market here, is a form of vertical integration. And to combine that with research and then later with the call center business, you know, is a form of vertical integration, in my view. You may disagree with me, but I learned that vertical integration piece from the Irvings, to be candid about it, and just by observing what they were doing. And then so in our own very small way, we replicated that, and it served us exceedingly well. Yeah. So that was a strategy. That was a strategy. Yeah. Yeah.
So I just paused. David, after selling Hawk and completing your non-compete agreement with the new owners of Hawk, you eventually ended up working with one of your major competitors at the time, Color, who was then a member of the CCL group. That's when we actually worked together during that period and became really friends. Mm-hmm. Tell us about your rationale to join Color and maybe what you learned from that experience.
Yeah. Well, that's a great question. It really, really is, because it was such a dramatic departure from the world I'd been in. You know, I was not an owner or shareholder at Color. I was, in effect, an employee. And it was the first time I had been an employee since I moved to the Maritimes, which was, what was that, 30 years before, something like that. And so being an employee was a completely different experience. You know, I remember that first Friday night going home and not having to worry about the payroll or the rent or the cost of capital. So I remember this, you know, I had the weekend off, more or less. It was kind of crazy. So I got one of the things that happened there is I got to focus strictly on new business and servicing clients, right? That became 90% of the focus. It was very, very interesting. But the reason I joined Color was really I'd sort of been in a kind of quasi-retirement, not exactly. I'd been doing I used to laugh during that interim period between when we sold Hawk and when I joined Color. I used to say I was a full-time professional volunteer who paid no taxes any longer because they didn't make any money. And so it was kind of an opportunity to get back on the ice, right, and maybe score a few goals. But you may remember, Don, that Maurice Robichaud had left Color New Brunswick to join the provincial government at the time, and there was a big hole there. And Maurice asked me if I would consider, and the president of Color, Chris Keevil, asked me if I would consider helping out for a few weeks or for a few months. And I don't want to sound too altruistic or anything about this, but my sort of value system clicked into gear at that point. And I realized that I could be of service. You know, I just realized there weren't a lot of people hanging around, unemployed, hanging around New Brunswick that could fill that role. But I knew that I could do an okay job, right? And so I think really I was ready to stop being a full-time volunteer. So I think it was a combination of factors. And I just really wanted to help out. And so I had a lot of respect for the people at corporate communications or Color, including yourself and Steve. And I thought, well, I'm going to learn a lot here. And I did. I learned a heck of a lot, because CCL was in many respects a better company than Hawk. It was, you know, it was more disciplined, better structured, just had a whole bunch of cultural elements that I thought, well, this would be great to great to experience all of this and learn from it. And I did. So those are my reasons. And then, you know, quite candidly, I got to get, as I say, back on the ice, score a few goals, make some more money. There was a whole range of factors. And that led to me staying in the business for what turned out to be another 12 or 14 years, right? And, you know, I might have been getting a bit bored at the time. And so I got rid of the boredom. You know, these are just personal things that are factors in people's lives, right? I mean, you hear all kinds of talk about people retiring when they're whatever age. And then, you know, whether it's 55 or 60 or 65, and they enter a phase of their life where, in fact, they do get kind of bored in some cases. And I think I had started working at a very young age. It was just part of who I was, and work is what I did, and I enjoyed working. So I think it was that's a potpourri of reasons, but I think in there are what motivated me.
So in 2011, you formed XYZ Communications with Lori and another partner, Brian Jamieson. And then shortly thereafter, you co-founded another company in 2012 called BrainWorks with your wife and Brad LeBlanc.
Yeah.
Just give us a little overview of those two companies.
Sure. So XYZ was a very small consultancy that and I would emphasize the word consultancy. It wasn't all that interested in execution. It was more interested in strategy, and then we would typically kind of job out the executional component, and it didn't have its eyes set on doing on a lot of growth. Brian and I were really good at doing the work together. We enjoyed the projects. I'll speak strictly for myself, but I enjoyed working with Brian on the projects. I enjoyed advancing the projects, and I felt that overall we did really good work for our clients. When I look back on the projects that we undertook, I'm really, 90% of them I thought, well, we brought a lot of value to those clients. But the focus was never execution. We didn't have anybody internal that did art direction or any copywriting or anything else. I was kind of the quasi creative director at XYZ. So what happened is a year after we started XYZ, Brad LeBlanc came along and said that he wanted to, he had no resources and he wanted to kickstart a small agency, and he was quite interested in execution, right? And so he wanted to know if Lori and I would back him. And so he was starting from nothing. I admired his entrepreneurial spirit, his energy, his creativity. You know, Brad's got a lot of assets, and he's got an extremely strong, positive work ethic. And so I said, well, fair enough, Brad. I mean, it's not a conflict with anything we're doing. In fact, at XYZ, in fact, you know, if you get up and running and got some resources, we'll be a client. You know, you can do a lot of our execution. So they were two different parts of the industry. And the arrangement with Brian kind of ran its course after 7 or 8 years. And then we no longer wanted to do that. At least I didn't. And Brad had accelerated BrainWorks into a fairly sizable organization that had a whole range of, generally speaking, relatively small clients that he was serving well, and very focused around creativity and execution, design, and that. And so I had no intention of being part of BrainWorks full time, but all of a sudden we started to grow BrainWorks, and it kind of needed me full time, or needed somebody, and there I was available. So we took BrainWorks forward from there, and we grew that to about, well, from an employee standard, we grew that to about 23 people, and we were doing work all over the Maritimes and taking on projects that many other people really either wouldn't or couldn't take on. Just they didn't have the skill set or the interest or the drive or whatever. So one of those, as an example, was helping the credit unions in Nova Scotia bring Obama into Halifax, which was a big event and required a lot of resources to make happen successfully. And I'll just use that as an example. But that was a very, very successful undertaking for the credit union and for us. I needed to get out of the business completely about a little over a year and a half ago. Frankly, I was at the burnout stage again. We had been through the pandemic and then the fire, and we had made it through both somehow or other. I was extremely tired, but my wife, as you know, had some very serious health issues and just required my full attention. So, And we, you know, by then we had really successfully made it through the pandemic and the fire crisis. Actually, we made money both of those years, rather astonishingly. It was like a miracle that we had gone through those 2 years and actually had a pretty solid bottom line. Yeah. It's almost like an act of God. It's astonishing. But you know, we had a great team at BrainWorks. And again, I'd like to emphasize that, you know, Brad had this very strong work ethic and was very entrepreneurial. And really together, we were able to negotiate all of the challenges of those very, very difficult years.
Well, David, that's a good way to conclude the first of our two-part conversation with you. So we'll look forward to picking up the conversation next week. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Insights Podcast from the Acadia Broadcasting Corporation. Follow the show and listen to past episodes on your favorite podcast platform like Apple or Spotify. If you've enjoyed the show, why not recommend it to a friend? Don and David will be back next week with another deep dive into some key issues in Atlantic Canada.